Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Goods, a film podcast. This is Brian here, and I'm with Dan.
Hey, Brian. Hey, listeners.
This is episode 97 of the podcast, and it continues one of our theme months. This is week three of what we're calling Animonth, where we are covering animated films, more specifically, feature-length animated films made by a studio other than Disney, released prior to the year 1990.
Exciting times.
Yes. How've you been doing, Dan? How's your week?
Good. Finally sold my old house. It took way too long.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, so otherwise just been pretty busy. School started with my kids, extracurricular activities started, so been a logistics heavy week, but I did manage to catch up with our feature film of the week.
That's good. Yes, busy week for me too, but I watched the movie, which in this case is Wizards from 1977, directed by Ralph Bakshi. Now, attentive listeners may remember that just 2 weeks ago, we had another movie, also by Ralph Bakshi, and not too dissimilar to this one, in fact. Not too removed in terms of time or tone or topic from this movie. Because even though last time Dan threw us all the way back to the beginning of animated film with Prince Ahmed, and seems like he's really striving to provide some good variety and a bit of a history lesson this month, I am not promising the same thing. In fact, I think you could classify all of my picks for the month even more narrowly than we've done so far. It's not just pre-1990 non-Disney. It's specifically all 1970s fantasy animation, so.
Huh. Including your next pick.
Including my next pick. So you'll just have to see what that's going to be, but let's cover the topic at hand first. So I read a little more about Ralph Bakshi prior to our coverage this week that I'll kind of maybe be sprinkling it in.
Yeah, I actually read the chapter on him in my animation history textbook that I talked about last week.
Oh, yeah. I see you've made some notes here in our little Google Doc.
Sure. So, and I apologize if clear my throat a lot or sound kind of scratchy. I'm also fighting off a cold. But yeah, Ralph Bakshi is a really interesting figure in animation history. He was born in 1938 in Israel, although he grew up in New York. And there's kind of a theme of him struggling with the chaotic urban mess and sprawl that I think is an undercurrent for many of his works. I would say today's for sure. And he got into animation pretty young, and he worked at Terrytoons, which I briefly mentioned last week. It's the one that their most famous series was Mighty Mouse. And he kind of worked his way up there. And then in 1967, when he was 29 years old, he formed his own studio, I think just called Bakshi Studios or something like that. And this was actually like in some ways an auspicious time for him to do so, because there was about to be a very large void in the world of animation. In fact, there recently had been a large void, because just the previous year, Walt Disney, the main shepherd and creative vision of animation for decades in the American studio system, or at least one of them, passed away. And Walt Disney Animation Studio, which had been the biggest brand in feature animation for sure in America, only released 5 films in the 15 years after Walt Disney passed, 2 of which were projects that were started by Disney himself, one of them being The Jungle Book and one of them being the Winnie the Pooh movie, which was stitched together from some of the shorts that Disney produced. But back to Bakshi, you know, with kind of this void in the world of animation, after doing a little bit of TV work, he pivoted to doing low-budget indie animated features. And the way that he kind of made inroads was he kind of rode the quote-unquote comics, C-O-M-I-X, wave of animation and cartoons. And they were typically transgressive and provocative in some way, and aimed at adults is a big thing. A lot of raunch and violence and sex in them, a lot of rebellion in them, kind of right around, of course, the same time as other cultural revolutions going on in America. And Bakshi really rode this wave. You know, he never had like a monster 9-digit blockbuster success, but he had a lot of small to medium successes. His most famous string of movies were like deliberately adult oriented.
Right. The one that always gets talked about that film people tell you you gotta see is Fritz the Cat, which is like what kicked off his wave of success. And as you're saying, it was the first X-rated animated feature.
Yeah. And he also made, there is one called Coonskin. He made one called Cool World. And eventually he decided he wanted to pivot more towards, I don't know, family, probably not family, but like away from the shtick being that it was just kind of grotesque and adult into kind of a more fantasy realm.
Right. He wanted to be more than dirty Disney.
Right.
And yeah, I'm curious about Cool World, which came out a little later and was kind of like a raunchier Roger Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
But the one that I think I'm most interested in after reading his bio is Coonskin. It sounds interesting because even though he was an Israeli immigrant, his family settled in a neighborhood that was almost exclusively black, and he went to a black school. And so he identified strongly with that community. And the film, it's like a more modern retelling of the Uncle Remus stories, as was Song of the South, the controversial Disney film you can't watch anymore. And I don't know, it sounds really interesting. Sounds unique.
Yeah, that would definitely be one I'd be interested to see. I have a feeling his adult ones would probably be too tasteless and kind of eye-rolly, cringy, provocative.
It'd be hard for us to summarize, perhaps.
Yeah.
Not that the one we're talking this week is particularly easy to summarize.
For different reasons, I would say, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, when you picked Lord of the Rings 2 weeks ago, and this were actually the first times that I had seen a Bakshi film. First time I had finally tracked him down. And I think it's interesting is that this one, I think, is like very deliberately a precursor to Lord of the Rings, which would use a lot of similar techniques to what we saw today.
Yeah, a lot of the same animation techniques, heavy use of rotoscoping, heavy use of like live action footage with a filter slapped over it that I think I read was called solarization, something I've never seen outside of these movies. And if I were being consistent, truly consistent, then the next one I would pick, well, I would have started with Wizards because it came out first, and then I would have followed up with Lord of the Rings, and then the next fantasy movie he did was called Fire and Ice. But that's not going to be pick number three. But it looks interesting. I've seen some clips from that one, too.
Yeah, I saw that one listed and vaguely intrigued by it as well.
Did you have any more Bakshi tales to tell?
I guess just the last thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, prior to Bakshi, almost all of the animated features of notes had been made by studios that had been around since the 20s, 30s, 40s. And so this was kind of an upstart indie project that got some actual traction and used some technical innovation. And I think, you know, I didn't see any specific cited examples, but the textbook said he's credited with kicking off indie animation in general as like a force that got any level of notable visibility. So I think that's kind of cool that you could just go out there and make something, you know? I mean, we talked about this point a year ago, more than a year ago, the Care Bears movie, which, say what you will about the creative output of that, was just made by two dudes who made a studio, you know? And then now, of course, with the technology at your fingertips, anyone who puts their mind to it can make something, so.
Right, you can get all kinds of output. coming from every which way. It made me think, reading about it, of the Flash cartoons in the early 2000s.
I like that, yeah.
Like middle school and high school, when really, truly anybody could be making animation that was pretty good. I mean, it's certainly the technology has evolved and become cheaper.
Yeah. And I guess with the internet, the distribution has changed too. It's easier for people to find your stuff, you know?
Right.
Share it with anyone. You don't need to rent out a screening hall or mail a reel around or a videotape or anything like that.
Right. You might be wondering why I settled on to like exclusively 70s fantasy animation. I can't say for sure, other than I like the vibe. That's a term I throw around a lot on this podcast. And this genre from this era certainly has a distinctive vibe. And when we were talking Lord of the Rings, either in the recent episode or when we were talking to Will a couple weeks back, you mentioned that like fantasy has seen a couple resurgences and that we still have stuff like Game of Thrones going strong and that there have been various booms. But I almost feel like it's just aftershocks of the late 70s, early 80s. Like, I think that's what kickstarted their, like, being conventions and, you know, a string of movies like this, Dungeons & Dragons coming out. And maybe I've just got it on the brain because it's Maryland Ren Fair season again.
Oh, we might have to do our annual rewatch.
Yeah. I assume you mean a rewatch of Max Magician and The Legend of the Ring.
Yes.
The greatest fantasy film ever made.
Of course.
And you might be right. But are you ready to talk about this 1977 motion picture first?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Interestingly, this movie was made for Fox in the same year that Star Wars was released. So they were being made at the same time. And there was some level of communication between Ralph Bakshi and George Lucas. Like, they would be at the same meetings asking the producers for more money.
Ralph Bakshi's still alive, by the way. He's 83 years old.
Oh, wow. Well, George Lucas is still alive, too.
That's true. I don't know why. I just always assumed that he was dead. Just seems like someone from a previous era.
Yeah.
But I guess Lucas is the same way.
Right. This movie was originally going to be titled War Wizards, which is thematically fitting, but it was changed at George Lucas's request. We can't be both putting out war movies at the same time, war title films. And I guess he probably argued that you could more easily have a movie just called Wizards than one just called Star.
Yeah. Man, I guess I didn't even piece that together, but 77, or the year that Star Wars came out, or was it 78?
Right, right.
So this is like concurrent with the birth of the blockbuster as well.
And I'm going to launch into a plot recap here, but I just want to give a heads up that, to me at least, a lot of stuff happened that didn't make a whole lot of sense and just kind of came and went. Not a super long film, but I don't know, episodic events and odd fantasy occurrences. But I guess that's what we're here for.
Yeah, it's a 80-minute film that I thought felt like a 95-minute film or something. It didn't feel short to me.
Right. I think I'm in the same boat. But I will say, this is actually the movie that inspired the month.
Oh, really?
It is, because I had wanted to at some point talk about the animated Lord of the Rings, mostly because of my fever dream anecdote. Listen back to that episode if you're confused. And I also wanted to talk about the movie coming up, my last pick of the month. But, you know, two movies doesn't make a month. Not if you're the launcher and steerer of the month. You got to have three, so I happened to be watching trailers for various movies, and this one came up, and it looked so weird. And the poster has this odd red robot on it, And I thought, I got to see this one. It looks like it would fit in alongside those other two movies I want to talk about. So that's what got us here.
Gotcha, yeah. What was the link you sent me? There's like some other kind of genre. The sword and planets or something?
Oh, yes. So the Wikipedia article for Wizards says it's an example of the sword and planet genre, which I think you could just call science fantasy. That's a term that gets used a lot for Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's sort of a subset of that. And it borrows from the tradition of sword and sandal, which we've talked about some. Things like on the fantastical end, you have things like Clash of the Titans, to more historically rooted ones like the biblical epics, Ten Commandments, Cleopatra, that type of stuff. But sword and planet takes place in outer space. And I would guess typically features big battles.
Interesting, yeah.
But with that kind of dated military aesthetic, like ancient and medieval systems of warfare, primarily.
Right.
An example that was listed was the John Carter series by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Oh, and that had a 2012 flop by one of the Pixar directors. I think it was Andrew Stanton.
Yeah. There were a couple big profile, expensive Disney blockbusters around that time that didn't go anywhere. There was John Carter, and they did that Lone Ranger movie with Johnny Depp. Maybe we'll have to visit one of those at some point.
Disney Flops Month would be another interesting counterpoint to this month.
Ooh, yeah. That's a good idea. We might have to come to that at some point. But in the story of Wizards, we open with this prologue where this kind of spooky female narrator speaks over a bunch of still illustrations, like storybook pages. And I thought, like, of the whole movie, this art looked the best. But at the same time, it goes on for like a couple minutes and it's not really animation.
Yeah, it's mostly still. And with like compositing these, I don't know if it's stock footage or stuff he actually filmed in the background, like as you see a still image.
Right. Yeah, I did read that this movie used a lot of stock footage. Like, for battle scenes, he just took movies that already had battle scenes in them and then, like, traced over them.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I have some thoughts on the myriad influences feeding into this film as we go. It's like a wild 5 minutes. It's like, I was expecting 15 seconds of exposition, and it turns into more than 5 minutes of exposition. Which, that doesn't maybe sound like that much, but when it's like talking about like insane apocalypses and fantasy creatures and wizards and stuff, it comes at you real fast.
Right. And you gotta hear the voice of this narrator, because she's like in a dream state or something. It's trance-like. He's like, in the beginning, there was the Great War. And then the ancestors of humanity reemerged. As we're panning and scanning over these storybook pages. And basically what it boils down to is this world has Adventure Time rules. Where at some point in the distant past, there was a nuclear war that destroyed the planet. And now we're many, many eras later. And like any humans that are left are all mutants. But also some friendlier fantasy creatures have emerged. So we have dwarves and elves and fairies now. At least they tell us there are dwarves. I don't think we ever see any dwarves.
Yeah, it's kind of incoherent. It's like there were creatures that just appeared on screen that they were just like generic fantasy illustration. Like, I don't know if there was any thought into like what the different speciation is and what their roles are, with a couple of exceptions that will become relevant to the middle of this plot.
They also spell out pretty clearly, pretty on the nose, that there's a dichotomy in this world, a conflict between magic and technology, and that those are our two warring forces. And not just that, but magic, which is what the fairies and all of them have, is good, and technology is bad. And, I mean, this is far from the only movie to make this message. We said it's the same year as Star Wars, and all throughout Star Wars, at least the original trilogy, you've got that message. It's like it's the organic versus the industrial, the Ewoks versus the chicken bots.
Right. And I think this is a reflection of humanity's inherent inability to grasp with how fast technology has changed. You know, I know Lord of the Rings itself isn't about technology explicitly, but like the notion of a all-powerful ring that can control mass minions, and like the way that Sauron is able to, like, I don't know, essentially mass produce troops with these orcs and stuff, has a similar vibe. It's just the depersonalization of industrial forces is the real enemy.
Definitely. And at some point during this exposition blizzard, it starts talking about this fairy queen who gives birth to twin wizards. And the wizards are Avatar, the good wizard, and Black Wolf, the mutant wizard. Which, that's a great name. At the same time, though, what do you expect to happen if you name your kid Black Wolf, the mutant wizard?
Well, I feel like Black Wolf is the kid's name. And mutant wizard is a name he adopted after he gained his traits, but...
That's fair. But even just Black Wolf, I feel like, is setting him on a path.
Is there like a thing? I think there is. I didn't follow a lot of this movie, but there's like hints of the humans are trying to birth humans and not mutants. And Avatar is definitely not a normal human. He doesn't look like one, at least. But there's something with Black Wolf where he's apparently a mutant based on his name. And there's like a thing later where he's like, he has a kid and he's like, is it a mutant or a human? So I guess you can be one or the other. I don't know.
Yeah. So have you seen Mad Max 4, the Fury Road one?
No.
Oh, man, you got to see that. But
yeah, no, I really want to.
That basically has the same thing where it's the apocalypse and there's this evil warlord and he's basically keeping all the genetically viable women for himself, and he's trying to have a kid who's not a mutant.
Oh, interesting.
So that was making me think of that, and that's always the question of how much mutant is in there, because if it's too much mutant, we don't want it. But yeah, so there is that going on. Black Wolf is out in the wasteland because after the fairy queen dies and there are these two claimants to the magical throne, I guess. Avatar and Black Wolf have a battle, and Avatar prevails, and so he gets to stay and rule the nice, pretty fairyland, which they call Montagar, and Black Wolf has to go off Scar-style and rule this dark land called Scorch. And then we jump ahead a bit, and we see what the brothers are up to later on in their maturity. There are some interesting character designs in this movie. Avatar, what does he look like? He definitely looks like something off of an R. Crumb poster.
He looks like a yard gnome, almost.
Yeah, yeah. He's got this big bulbous nose, and like you never see the top of his head because it's under a gnome hat. And he's got the big beard, and he smokes cigars with his feet.
Right. He, like, I don't know, when I saw that it was going to be Avatar versus Black Wolf, I expected Avatar to basically be a He-Man-style hero. And then it pans, I was like, wait, that's Avatar? It looks like the comic relief character who would be the side character, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know too much about, like, the 70s music scene or the counterculture. I just know he clearly looks like he was birthed by that counterculture.
Yeah.
Like something that would be on one of your dad's record covers that you dig out of a box.
For sure. This movie is a nonstop trip. It always feels like somebody took some acid at Woodstock and then came and made a film.
That's very fair. And maybe that's the vibe that I'm picking up on from 70s fantasy that's just slowly wearing off or slowly, like, dissipating into the more mainstream culture. It was just, like, a really strong hit of the drug scene, the drug culture.
Yeah.
That has, what's the word? Just been absorbed, been... When something goes through a barrier, osmosized.
Sure.
Osmoses.
Yeah. And there's like almost no preparing you for the weird arrangement of colors and visual textures. We talked a little bit about it with Lord of the Rings, how it was like seven different animation styles in one movie. And this is the same way. You have these watercolor backgrounds that are not like, when I think of watercolors, I think of light colors, almost pastel-y type colors. But this is like browns and greens that are kind of ugly, creating this like almost hallucinatory color scheme. And then you have all these expositional segments that are like just brown, like something that would be a picture in a Dungeons and Dragons book, like almost sepia toned. And then you have all these other weird effects that get tossed in. You have some of the rotoscoping that we talked about, just so much weird stuff. So the movie never lets you get an even keel on like what its look is.
Right, which was the same thing we said about Bakshi's Lord of the Rings. It's never really consistent.
Yeah.
And with this one, I mean, I had seen the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings movies multiple times, so I kind of had a roadmap to go from of what was going to be up next. Here, I didn't have that. And I know in that one, you probably didn't have much of that. But I was taken out of it just by how inconsistent everything was. It's like, well, all right, movie, you're in control. Bakshi, take the wheel.
A possible episode title.
But yeah, we're finally out of this big prologue thing. And we see the present of our story world. And Avatar is training the president's daughter to be a full-fledged fairy, which, okay.
Yeah, that is as much context as we get. There's no more context given. It's, yeah.
Yeah, we're just dropped in here, and they say she's going to be a full fairy multiple times, but they never explain what that means. They don't say why she isn't one yet. Also, like, every other fairy that we see in the movie is like Tinkerbell sized, like tiny, 6 inches tall. But I guess she is one too, and she is standard human size. So there's that.
And there's lots of lingering adult animation type stuff in this. And by far the most obvious one is this fairy. Is it Eleanor? Eleanori? Something like that?
Yeah, Eleanor.
She is basically a nude woman. I mean, she has like a very strappy thing that covers the parts, but like are still form-fitting to the parts. So she essentially looks like a naked woman.
Right. It's a technicality. Yeah. But the president, who we don't see for very long.
I was mad.
Is terrifying. I was afraid of this person. Because he's wearing, like, a Phantom of the Opera mask that has clown makeup painted on top of it. And he has a big top hat and, like, a tail coat. And one presumes there is some kind of human form under there, but I'm not sure.
Would you vote for him for president, Brian? The fact that he's president and not another role?
That's the other thing, is we were just talking about kings and queens, and this is a medieval world. But I guess it's a democracy now.
I don't know. Are we? Maybe, I guess.
Who can say? But
how else could you be a president?
He's gone pretty fast, though, because he like immediately gets assassinated.
More abrupt deaths than I was expecting in this film.
Yes. Quite a few. Also, I will say, you know, you were talking about that it feels like a constant trip. Just be ready for the next one that I pick.
Okay.
Because it goes completely off the rails in that regard. It is, I mean, that is my definition of a trip movie. So.
All right, I'm excited.
This is perhaps a good preparation. And so, yeah, now the president is out of the picture. And he was assassinated by this robot from the poster who shows up. and we learn his name is Necron 99, which to me is the most iconic, memorable thing about this movie. It was the thing I was on the lookout for, because like I said, they put him on the cover of the movie, they put him on the poster. And so, Dan, could you describe the look of this robot a little bit?
Yeah, he's humanoid. He's got on an outfit that is vaguely soldier-esque. It's kind of got like a uniform look to it, but it's all the same shade of red. So it looks like maybe a kid's book or something illustration. And then he's got these creepy eyes. Like, I wouldn't even have pegged him as a robot because he has these creepy expressive yellow eyes that come out. I guess the giveaway that he's a robot is he's got a little boingy boing antenna on top of his head.
Right. So my description is that he looks like Dr. Seuss's version of Bender from Futurama.
Mm.
Like, his body shape is very similar to Bender. He's got the little antenna on top of his head, and his eyes look the same, where he's got like a brow ridge that sticks out off of his face, and then he's got the light up eyes on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
But then he's all covered with, this uniform that's made of all one piece of fabric, and it's kind of bunchy and droopy at places. It looks like he's wearing a thneed from the Lorax.
Mmm, good connection.
And so that's what I was thinking. Oh, by the way, Avatar, the main character, is voiced by Bob Holt, who did a lot of animation voice work, especially on the Dr. Seuss TV specials. He narrated and voiced the characters in the 1972 Lorax.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I can hear that now that I'm thinking about it.
Some other things. He did the Sneetches one. And he was also the voice and the host of Huber Bloob Highway, which we've name dropped.
Huber Bloob Highway. Yeah. Wow. A lot of interesting and bizarre voice performances in this movie.
Oh, for sure. Because there's this other guy who becomes very prominent, even though I could never say at any point that I really knew him or anything about him. But there's this elf warrior named Weehawk, and his vocal performance was all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, when the president dies, he walks in and, you know, he's supposed to be the bodyguard or something, and the president has just been assassinated, and he says, "I failed you, my lord. I failed you, my lady." And it's just this completely monotone, devoid of emotion delivery. And it's like, this seems like it should be a dramatic moment, but that's not what I'm getting from you.
But he has some outbursts later, so I don't know.
Yeah, later, they must have given him notes or something for later in the movie, because later he's screaming all the time.
Maybe that's some of these sessions he took coke and some of them he didn't take coke.
There's a couple scenes early on when Black Wolf, the bad guy, tries to attack the Good Kingdom a couple times. He's got armies of orcs and things that are trying to invade, but they can never maintain morale for long or cogency as a military unit. But this changes because Black Wolf has like a team of researchers, kind of Indiana Jones style, scouring the world for technology that predates the apocalypse. So they're looking around for weapons especially, but then the big thing that they find is Nazi propaganda films and a projector to play them on. And they bring these back to Black Wolf, and now he has an army of literally Nazis.
Nothing could have prepared me for the Nazi propaganda in the middle of our animated fantasy film with fairies and stuff. Just literally Hitler pull up on screen and shouting in German.
Yeah, so literally you've got orcs with swastika armbands here.
I was like, what the hell is going on? I was digging it, though, because it's like with Lord of the Rings, he was bound by, you know, the classic text. Here, he could just do whatever the hell he wanted. You want Nazi propaganda 20 minutes into your weird dystopian fantasy elf wizard war movie? Fuck it, dude. We got Nazis now. That's fine.
And this is what prompted me to look up some biographical information on Ralph Bakshi because I was like, is he maybe Jewish? And yes, he is. But yeah, so we got Nazis in the mix now, and this propaganda played off the projector, like, pumps up his forces, and now Black Wolf is a force to be reckoned with.
And this is one time in the movie that the movie, it just devolves into like a fantasia of like seven different animation styles, like assaulting your senses with the evil imagery and color schemes and stuff, and just get these weird, almost expressionistic shots and freaky goblin creatures and stuff. It's wild. And I liked, I don't know, it felt like he was trying to get at something, like some thought on the power of image, and that's the real magic or something. It had this really detailed close-up on the film projector, and that recurred later at the end, too.
Right, they call the film projector a dream machine, and it's got some kind of, like, magical boosting going on because it can also, like, cast the movie over the battlefield, and so that the whole opposing force, all the elves, can see like the Nazis marching around. So there's more to it, it seems, than just a standard movie projection. But yeah, really well put, Dan. I thought so many times during this movie, I think he's trying to say something here. But rarely was it completely clear. And when it was clear, it felt like I was getting hit by a hammer. But yeah.
I mean,
as with the animation style, inconsistent.
George Lucas dressed up his bad guys as Nazis. Ralph Bakshi literally played a picture of Hitler and Nazi soldiers marching as the bad guys rallied. So just in case that parallel was just a hair too subtle for you in Star Wars, here we got it. No question. Bad guys are Nazis.
Yep. But Avatar and his gang find out that this projector is what's making Black Wolf strong, giving extra oomph to his guys. And so they need to travel into the Badlands, Lord of the Rings style, and they got to destroy this thing. And so they form up their little posse, and it's Avatar and Eleanor the Fairy and this elf guy, Weehawk. But also, Avatar reprograms the war robot, and he names it Peace. And so that's going along with them, too. And this was a story point that was recently the crux of a couple Mandalorian episodes, where they had like an assassin robot and then they turn it good and then everybody's kind of on the fence. Ooh, is it actually going to stay good? Did this really work? Or is it going to snap at a key moment and kill everybody?
That's interesting, yeah.
So they're on their big movie-spanning quest now. Get to the bad guy and break the projector. But on this quest, a whole lot of stuff just kind of happens. And, like, the group keeps getting broken up and reassembled, and it was never really clear to me why, like, what was the purpose of any specific thing that happened until they finally, like, are knocking on Black Wolf's door.
Right. And this middle period is where I felt the drag, because it just breaks into these scenes that are, like, almost mini-contained films that aren't, like, fully developed ideas. And it just, there's like six of them before we get to the climax.
Uh-huh. They encounter a group of fairies, again, like these little small fairies. And they're led by a fairy prince. And it was like, I know that voice. Who is that? And it's Mark Hamill in his first role. So like,
whoa.
Bakshi borrowed him for a day off of the Star Wars set. And this movie actually came out first, so this was Mark Hamill's film debut.
Wow. I think that's what he's best known for today, is weird-looking fucking gnome guy.
As Fairy Prince Sean, Mark Hamill, yeah.
In 1977's Wizards. I almost called it Warriors.
But again, like as soon as they meet this dude and you got Mark Hamill talking, he gets assassinated by somebody unseen. He's just shot and he's dead.
Yeah.
And we know, I think, that the, like, killer robot is reformed. Maybe there's some brief speculation that it could have been him, but it's not him. I actually am not 100% on who killed this guy.
Who killed Luke Skywalker?
But Avatar gets blamed for it, and so for a little while, he's strung up by the fairies, and they're going to kill him, and they're, like, attacking him. But he refuses to fight back, because Avatar is a pacifist. He doesn't believe in war, he doesn't believe in technology. This impresses the Fairy King, who I guess is Mark Hamill's dad. It's not dwelled on, but I think that's the connection. And so he just sends Avatar on his way. Just exemplary of the very episodic nature.
Right. The Eleanor is tied up at some point. Like, this is where I was, like, a little unnerved and could tell that he had made some, like, sexually weird stuff in his past, because she's like, there's like fairies crawling on her when she's all tied up, and again, remember, she's essentially nude here.
Oh yeah, we got some S&M, some damsel in distress stuff. But while that scene is going on, I wasn't going to talk about it, but since you brought it up, I'm going to talk about it. Like, through her bonds, she casts a spell that brings these gargoyles to life. And she says, oh, I guess I do have my fairy powers. And it was, again, just had me thinking, okay, what are the boundaries on this thing? How do you know when you're a full fairy? What sets them apart from a half fairy or whatever you thought you were? How does this determine that you're one or the other?
Right. All valid questions that this movie has no interest in answering.
But eventually, they all end up back together again, because there's, like, a bit where Weehawk is off by himself. He's, like, stuck in a hole and fighting some kind of animal. And it wasn't as cool as when Prince Ahmed was doing it with the snake.
No.
But it was basically the same scene as, like, falls down in a crevasse and this thing comes out. But they all wind up back together, and they're on the move, and soon they're just outside of Scorch, where Black Wolf is the king. But camped on the boundaries is an army of elves, and they have actually learned their lesson. You know, they're learning from Black Wolf's forces. They are boning up on technology and starting to use guns instead of swords. You know, the kind of thing that real life militaries would do. It's like, once somebody gets an edge, you got to catch up. But Avatar doesn't like the looks of this, because as we know, he's a pacifist. He likes magic and not technology. And so he's like, I don't know, elf general. This isn't really our way.
And this whole segment, the film once again, like, dissociates out of any comprehensible continuity. Like, I think we're seeing all the bad troops prepping for battle, but it's like this 4-minute segment of just all these weird bits of, like, technological evilry clashing against each other. Really wild stuff.
Another thing that happens a couple times in the movie is we get these, like, improvised comedic relief skits where it's like two evil soldiers shooting the shit. What did you think of these scenes, Stan?
I suppose against reasonable expectation, I actually liked them. I thought they were funny. I mean, the gags were never very clever, but some of them were kind of fun. And it was just, in addition to the kitchen sink mentality of the film, where, you know what, we're going to just do a little bit of everything here. And it's just going to add to the sort of hallucinatory cadence and texture of the film. So I thought it was fun.
That's fair. It felt the most cartoony.
Yeah, definitely.
It felt like something that would have come from one of Ralph Bakshi's other projects, from what I know of them. Like a Fritz the Cat type thing.
It's like that kind of carried over a little bit from his previous stuff.
Right. But while this army is camped outside the gates and they're going to launch their big offensive in the morning and besiege the town, Avatar and his team sneak into the city. They, like, go down the river or something, and they get into the center of town and are making their way to where Black Wolf is. Oh, something we skipped, because I don't clearly know how to explain it, but before they go into the city, Eleanor suddenly turns heel and kills the peace robot. She just obliterates him and then, like, cackles victoriously and jumps into one of the Nazi tanks and drives away. And everybody's like, what?
Everybody, including the viewer.
So, yeah. So now Eleanor's in there with Black Wolf. So Avatar and Weehawk are heading in to face Black Wolf. Specifically, Avatar is going to fight Black Wolf, and Weehawk goes off to find Eleanor and get her to explain herself, I guess. And the explanation that she gives, as best as I can understand it, is that the way the assassin robot worked is that he had, like, a little bit of Black Wolf's soul in him, and he's got, like, a good soul that's fighting the bad soul, and so he's always torn in conflict. And at one point, she touched him, like, she patted him on the back or something, and that allowed Black Wolf's soul fragment to possess her.
What's not straightforward about that, Brian?
It's like, did nobody else touch the robot? I'm pretty sure Avatar touched the robot, but maybe he's, like, powerful enough to withstand that kind of contact. Maybe he has brother-to-brother immunity or something.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, I guess she's good again. Because, like everything else, there's a lot of flip-flop happening abruptly. You establish something, and then you shatter the status quo. But Avatar climbs the dramatic staircase, and he gets into Black Wolf's lair, and they make their villain and hero monologues about the differences in their ideology, and they're about to do their big wizard duel, and Black Wolf makes some crack of, like, oh, you haven't used your magic for war in many a year, Avatar! And Avatar says, well, maybe not. And then he whips out a gun and he shoots him.
I was really not prepared for this. This was wild.
He pulls an Indiana Jones.
Yeah, exactly. We were just talking about that.
Yeah, and Black Wolf is just dead. And I was wondering what box he was trying to say here, because the whole movie Avatar has been saying, no, we don't use weapons, we don't use technology, we don't go to war that way. But I guess if you can't beat him, you join him. You know, you fight fire with fire.
Yeah, I think it was occurring to me that this movie actually was probably pretty heavily inspired by Lord of the Rings, even though he would go on to actually make Lord of the Rings next. But just the whole way that a small band of heroes are, like, traipsing into the dark, heavily guarded area, and the way that the protagonist is kind of struggling with the temptation of this great power in front of him. In this case, the dark magics are technology. And I think he was, like, trying to do something that kind of played with those themes and ideas and stuff, but it just felt totally out of left field and underdeveloped. It was just like a what the hell twist. That actually, I laughed out loud when it happened. I was like, this is genius. This is subversion.
Yeah, it's unexpected. It works. And then he, like, casts the gun away. So I guess it's a one and done.
Right.
You know? And yeah, like Lord of the Rings, they break this projector and the enemy army just melts away. Like, this is what was keeping them going and now it's gone. So the good guys are triumphant. And Avatar and Eleanor explain that they're a couple, which I think we could have gathered at this point, but they're like, yes, we have relations. And they say that they're going to stick around and, like, restore the blasted wasteland of Scorch. And they send Weehawk off to be the king of Montagar back in Fairyland. Although I thought we learned that Montagar had a president.
Well, the president was assassinated, so now, once one president is assassinated, we go back to kings. So now we have a king again.
Okay. Oh, by the way, just to put a little, you know, a pin in the calendar and set a timestamp for this episode, England just got a new king. That's the hot new story in the news. Man, 70 years he was the heir apparent from the time he was 3 years old.
That's crazy. How old do you think he'll be when he dies? It would be hilarious if it was like next week or something. Like by the time the listeners listen to this.
Well, I know you're going to be giving me updates, Dan, because for years he's been saying, oh, you know, they're looking askance at Queen Elizabeth's health. It's not looking too good. Well,
finally happened. I don't get too caught up in flag thumping patriotism, but I will always shit talk the British monarchy. Boo the king and the queen, while also still being kind of fascinated with them.
Yeah, I think it's cool that places still have some monarchies going on. But that's Wizards, 1977.
I want to, before we fully move away from the plot, point out one other thing that kind of struck me. I mentioned we get the zoom in on the projector, both towards the beginning of the movie and then at the end when Darkwing, what's the bad guy's name? Black Wolf. He gets killed by his brother, and then they kill his projector, too. But I was wondering if Bakshi was kind of working through, intentionally or otherwise, complicated feelings about censorship and censors. Because, of course, you know, he had been subject to much scrutiny about how provocative and controversial his work was, and there were attempts to make it harder to see his adult films. But if that's the case, he made the bad guy, the one who was using art for evil, and the good guy, the one who was coming to have it no longer be projected. Now, I know in this case, the quote-unquote art is straight-up Leni Riefenstahl Nazi propaganda, but I don't know. There was like a seed, a kernel of something there, right in the realm of, I think he was trying to say something, but I don't know what it actually was that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, quite a bit of that. But that is interesting. And when the projector is destroyed and things are returning to normal, the narrator says, Hitler was dead again.
Huzzah! We did it again.
Hooray.
You go, Ralph Bakshi. Pull in a Quentin Tarantino.
So what were some good things, Dan, about this movie? Anything you haven't called to mind yet?
I think I've hit most of them. I mean, I just like how varied and unpredictable the movie is and how that variability and unpredictability still kind of unifies into a whole just by nature of it always being that. And I also, for me, there's a... I've talked about this a lot, and I feel like I want to expand upon it someday. I don't think I'm going to do it right now because I haven't really thought through it, but there is good ugly and bad ugly, like avant-garde artistic ugly and just unpleasant to look at ugly. And to me, this was the good kind of ugly, just like an assault on my retinas in a way that always surprised and fascinated me. LSD
yeah.
trip.
Yeah, it's all over the place, for sure. We've said it multiple ways. And I did really like some of the character designs. The weird robot is very memorable. And, like, even things that scared me, like the strange president guy. I don't think I'm going to forget that for a while.
Real missed opportunity, though. You give us this guy and then you get rid of him. What if he was Hitler? That would have been something wild. Like he took off his hat, his mask, and Adolf Hitler was underneath.
Yeah. We will have to imagine what a wizard sequel would be because one was never made. There was one and done. Although, as we said, Bakshi obviously followed up with other fantasy films. I am curious to see Fire and Ice.
Yeah.
Any not-so-good things, Dan, that you haven't mentioned?
I mean, stuff we've already mentioned. If you care about a coherent plot or world-building, just don't even bother.
Yeah, that's right. Like, so much is inconsistent here. The narrative is inconsistent. The animation is inconsistent. And it drags a little bit because it's difficult to follow so much.
What did you make of technology versus magic as a theme, Brian? Did it work for you? Did you have no idea what he was doing with it?
Well, that's usually a pairing that I like. I mean, I like Star Wars. I even like seeing the Ewoks smash the logs together and destroying the big powerful robots. I thought it was a little ham-handed here. Just specifically making them Nazis and that's the threat that's back. I think the threat of industrial warfare is broader than that. I think it doesn't have to specifically be that ideology that motivates it. I don't know. What did you think?
I don't know. I thought it allowed the movie to engage with some really interesting visual ideas that kind of splatter across the screen and bounce off each other. I don't, as a story perspective, I don't think there was much depth to it, but yeah, I agree that there is something like enduringly appealing about the natural and the magic and the mystical as opposed to the mechanical, industrial, robotic. And I thought some of that was there.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's very rooted in the era, too. And maybe that's a reason for the poignancy and the popularity of the fantasy genre at this time. Is like in the waning days of Vietnam and afterwards, you know, there's a lot of distrust of the government and the military industrial complex, and like that goes against the human soul, and maybe it comes from the hippie movement of, you know, love and nature and music are the things that should endure and be celebrated, and we need to turn away from war.
Right. Yeah, kind of a carryover of that.
Yeah. Ultimately, I'm glad that I got to watch it. I've been waiting for a while. So now maybe is the time we answer, Dan. Is it good?
So Is It Good is our signature section where we each give the movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward good, which is an 8 out of 8. So I will answer, is Wizards good first? And by the way, those 8 ratings from 1 to 8 are very not good, not good, not good, good-ish, good, very good, exceptionally good, and our masterpiece rating, toward the good. So I don't think that this movie works in a conventional sense, but I do think it works as just this bizarre creation that is always unpredictable. And I got to be honest, I had a good time watching it. I think it's just more unhinged in a good way and a surprising way than Lord of the Rings, not bound to any specific plot that already has cultural weight and just could have all of the weirdest shit in there that he wanted to. It does drag in the middle, and you know that. So even despite being, like I said, 80 minutes, it feels a little slow, but you know, it's still 80 minutes. And so you're not going to waste your whole day watching it. So even if it's not your cup of tea, you'll be in and out pretty quickly. I don't know. I'm on the fence between a vague thumbs down and a vague thumbs up, but I'm just feeling positive towards its absurdity, its kaleidoscopic nature, its things that just astonished me, like a laugh out loud of shock from the mad villain getting shot Indiana Jones style, to all of a sudden Nazi propaganda, to the goofy, cartoony, bumbling guys accidentally shooting each other, the villain henchmen, to just these weird images and color splashes and stuff. You know, not every part is good or interesting. There are boring parts. But overall, I kind of was vibing with it, to use your word, Brian. I'm going to give this a very light good, 5 out of 8.
Oh, wow. So it matches up almost exactly then with George of the Jungle 2.
That's right.
Okay, interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear it. This one was a mess to me. I am going to give it a 2 out of 8, a not good, which is better than I gave George of the Jungle 2. I mean, it's clear he was trying to say something, but it's not always clear. Sometimes it's too clear. It's a journey. I mean, a lot of things occur. And I do like the vibe of the genre, and I think sometimes this movie hits its stride in that regard. I like the ethereal narrator and the, like, storybook illustrations. And as I said, some of the character designs I quite like. I think the regard I hold this movie in is that I wouldn't want to watch it again, but I want, like, merchandise related to it. Like, I kind of want a t-shirt with Avatar on it, or, like, a magnet for the bumper of my car that looks like the Red Robot. Like, I want people to know that I've seen it.
I want YouTube reaction videos to people seeing Hitler's floating face or the bad guy just getting shot after a long buildup. That's what I want to see.
Bring back YouTube React. And yeah, thanks for watching with me, Dan. What have you got planned next for our Anna Month?
It's been brought up thus far that I have a lot of interest in animation, and I have a lot of interest in kind of the history and evolution of animation, especially. Although, you know, maybe the ones I'm most passionate about are the ones that I watched when I was a young adult and a teen and a kid. That said, I just feel like I want to go out and see every oddball movement and movie and cult film that there is out there. But I can't, because we're doing a theme month. And so that means 5 total. You pick 3, I pick 2. And so I feel like there absolutely has to, if we're talking about animation, non-Disney, pre-1990, there absolutely has to be a anime film, a Japanese animation film, which is not actually my strongest suit in terms of knowledge or passion, I would say. I know a lot of people are really into Japanese animation.
Well, it sounds like a good idea, because when we say Animonth, I think people are going to think that there's going to be a lot of anime. So it's good that we have a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, what's the obvious pre-1990 anime film? Well, the first one to get any cultural traction in the US, and that's Akira, 1988. And I felt like that would be the pick in the spirit of Prince Ahmed, where we could have kind of the most discussion about the historically significant piece. But I just really didn't want to. I think it has a reputation for having like a long and convoluted plot, and it just seemed exhausting to me from the outside. I'm sure it's a good film, and maybe someday I will. I think someone on the Discord at one point wanted us to talk about it, and so for that reason, I almost decided to pick it. But you know what? F it. I don't want to pick it. I'm not going to pick it. I'm going to pick something that I actually want to watch more of, and that is the Anne of Green Gables 1979 adaptation that was directed by, I don't know how you say his name, Isao Takahata, who is probably second only to Miyazaki in terms of renown for Japanese features, animated features. And so this is, like I said, this is an adaptation. It's actually a 50-episode TV show. And Brian, I'm not going to ask you to watch 50 20-minute episodes between now and next week. But if I can find it and get it to you, there is a feature film that was made from, I think, the first 6 episodes. They kind of edited it into a single feature film.
Okay.
So I really want to talk more about this, and I'm going to see if I can track it down for you and send it to you. And if not, I will just send you the links to the first 5 or 6 episodes. They have both subs and dubs for this. So there is a good English dub, but there's also a sub. And I don't know if the feature film was dubbed, but I'll see what I can find and send it your way, Brian.
Okay, that's cool. I've never even heard of this. I do think it's really interesting when they do anime adaptations of Western stories, like Miyazaki did a Borrowers movie and stuff.
And a couple interesting things about this is this was actually the first collaboration between Takahata and Miyazaki. And I'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Miyazaki did some of the background paintings and designs, and they obviously ended up forming Studio Ghibli. I need to read up on exactly the mechanics of how that was formed, but they were two main directors for that studio for several decades. So it's kind of a cool thing where these two creative forces collaborated on this early work. So yeah, and it's also a stealth pick for our old theme month, which is young adult adaptations, because Anne of Green Gables is a, in some ways, proto YA novel from 1908. So we'll talk about that a little bit too. So Anne of Green Gables, 1979.
All right. This is going to be exciting. Thanks for bringing some variety when I definitely am not. But thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Join us again next time here on The Goods.
Bye, everybody.